I'm Suzanne Hogan, in for Steve Kraske, and this is Up to Date. If you're a gay, lesbian, bisexual, or transgendered Missourian, your chances of finding and getting the same level of health care as the rest of the state are significantly reduced. If you're LGBT, you're more likely to face conditions including heart disease, asthma, obesity, smoking-related illness, substance abuse, and depression. Today, a discussion on addressing the health needs of the LGBT population in Missouri. We'll examine what causes the disparities between LGBT and heterosexual Missourians and look at recommended policies that can promote health equity. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. I'm Suzanne Hogan, in for Steve Kraske, and this is Up to Date. Last month, the Missouri Foundation for Health published the latest paper in its health equity series, titled Responding to LGBT Health Disparities. The brief found, among other things, that lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgendered Missourians are more than twice as likely to not receive needed medical care compared to the general population. Sexual and gender minorities in Missouri are 1.5 times more likely to be uninsured than the general population. Today, we'll look at the factors influencing these and other disparities outlined in the paper. Joining us, Ryan Barker, is the Health Policy Director for the Missouri Foundation of Health and one of the editors of the report. He joins us this morning from the studios of in St. Louis Public Radio. Ryan Barker, good morning.
Good morning, Suzanne.
And in the studio, Stephen Lohman is a prevention specialist with the Kansas City Free Health Clinic. Steve, thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
Now, Ryan Barker, let's start with you. And to avoid any confusion, let's begin with some basic identification terms used in the study. LGBT, what do those letters stand for and what do they mean?
Right. So LGBT is lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender.
And could you talk about transgender, the difference between sexual orientation versus gender identity?
Absolutely. So when we think of lesbian, gay, and bisexual, that's really related to sexual orientation. So who are you attracted to? And transgender refers to, if you've heard the term gender identity, who you identify with as a gender. So you may physically, biologically be a male, but internally that your gender identity may be a female.
So, Ryan, can you tell us a bit about the information for this study? How was it collected and what were some of the sources?
Absolutely. So this is part of a broader series that we have done on health disparities. The foundation is interested in quality, affordable health care for all Missourians. And we have mostly looked at racial and ethnic disparities in the past. And this really came to light because there's a lack of information around the LGBT community and their health status. And so our researcher collected data, some very Missouri-specific, some more national. And part of what we point out in this report is that there is a lack of data available. Currently, there are no federal health surveys that collect data on sexual orientation or gender identity.
How much study has been done in the area of LGBT health issues by other states or nationally? I know you said that there hasn't been much, but of what has been done, what have you found?
You know, there are some surveys around the country, and even here in Missouri, there have been some localized studies looking at this population, collecting some health information. And so this is really what we think of as the most comprehensive report that has been done for Missouri on this topic, and really pulled all the available data that was available for the state. And then in times we had to fill in that data with some national surveys or looking at data from other states. So there's a wide variant. Some states collect pretty comprehensive data, and some states like Missouri, it's not included in any of our statewide surveys.
Do you know how Missouri ranks in comparison to other states then?
You know, in general, there's so many different health indicators that you could look at, but I would say in general, we're sort of middle of the road. There are states that are much worse than us in terms of some of these health indicators and states that are much better. So similar to other sort of health indicators within the general population, Missouri often ranks in the 30th or 40th compared to other states. And for this information, I would think that we're very similar to our general health indicators.
One of the things that the study finds is that a lot of LGBT people do not feel very comfortable being open to their health care providers. Stephen Lohman, is that something that the Kansas City Free Health Clinic encourages its patients to be forthcoming about?
I would think so. I mean, I've noticed that some people seem to be, so I would think so.
Can you ask somebody their gender orientation or their sexual identity?
I'm not 100% sure what they actually ask on the intake form.
Ryan, do you know that?
I don't know specifically that clinic, but that's actually one of the things that is really important in making a clinic or a healthcare setting very LGBT friendly or welcoming, is that we actually have those type of questions on the intake form where people feel like, oh, look, I can actually self-identify. This provider must be open to seeing this population. And so that is one of the important things, just from a clinical perspective, of making your provider setting welcoming to this community.
Is it important for a doctor to know your sexual identity? How can this information impact a patient in terms of preventative care?
Absolutely. So we know, and the study points out that about 30% of LGBT youth don't let their provider know about their sexual orientation or gender identity. And why is it important? As the report points out, there's a lot of additional stressors, discrimination, oppression, that minority populations often are impacted by. And so that leads to specific health concerns we see greater indicators in certain populations. And so it's important to self-identify in order for your provider to really understand your background. It's almost like part of your family history and understanding, well, this is where I'm coming from with my health. And that's an important demographic for your provider to know.
Stephen, how do you let patients know it's not only okay, but helpful for them to tell their doctors their sexual orientation or identity?
In the groups that I facilitate, I make sure to mention that in our patient-provider talk that we do in each one of the programs, that, you know, you do need to let that, you know, information be known to your provider, because that's very important. I mean, that might be part of, you know, the way that you're able to get better care. And so it's very important.
Stephen, could you go ahead and describe kind of the stuff that you do for Kansas City Free Health?
I do what is called the LIFE program, which is a 13-week program for HIV-positive white men who have sex with men, is the demographic that I serve in that program. And we deal with different cofactors like patient-provider relationships, you know, disclosing your HIV status to your family. And we do that through, they take out like a pre-test and a post-test to see where they are on each one of the cofactors. And then at the end of it, I mean, it's 3 hours, 13 weeks long. So, I mean, there's lots of information that we cover. And one of the things that we do talk about is the, you know, patient-provider relationship, to make sure that they do feel comfortable and that, you know, your provider works for you. So if you don't feel comfortable with your provider, then, you know, you can always go find another provider. So,
according to the paper, more than 2/3 of healthcare organizations do not require that physicians attend cultural competency training that includes LGBT health issues. Ryan, would you explain cultural competency?
Absolutely. So cultural competency training is related to working with many different cultures or minority groups. And so any provider should receive cultural competency training around working with different race or ethnic groups, different religious groups. And we would say, as what we point out in the paper, that it's important that the information about the LGBT community is included in any training that we give to providers in how to work with this population. Part of cultural competency is identifying your own biases as a human being. What do you maybe think or feel about a population? And just being able to identify those and be aware of them, so that when you're interacting with patients, that you're aware of your own biases and then can sort of catch yourself and know how to interact with different populations.
What are some of the LGBT-specific health issues that would be included in a training like that?
Absolutely. So sort of a lot around family support and community support. So we know that as when people come out, which come out as gay or lesbian or bisexual or transgender, that often sometimes families reject that individual. Sometimes families embrace them. And so often it becomes we find support or positive influence from a broader community. And it's important for providers to sort of understand that cultural framework of where support is coming from for these individuals or couples, and really get the different health issues that impact this population. So we, as you pointed out, we see higher rates of smoking. We see higher rates of obesity. When you are daily faced with sort of discrimination, harassment, that impacts your mental health, and so stress. We see higher rates of depression, higher rates of suicide attempts among the LGBT population. And so those are the type of health indicators that providers need to be aware of as they're working with patients that are part of this community.
Stephen, has the Kansas City Free Health Clinic received this type of training?
Yes, we have a cultural competency task force, and they do like a refresher course each year, and they pick different topics to talk about. And I'm sure that that's one of them that they will be putting through.
What kind of challenges have you personally faced in these trainings?
I personally have only been to one of them, so I haven't faced that many challenges. So I can't really talk about that one. So,
do you feel that medical personnel find it to be beneficial and learn a lot from it, or does it change the way that they provide care?
I think so. I think it does. I mean, that's what you would hope for. So
kind of along these same lines, the brief reported that fewer than 15 of 5,704 primary care physicians in the state of Missouri have registered as LGBT affirming in the Gay and Lesbian Medical Association's online provider network. Ryan, when a provider registers as LGBT affirming, what does that indicate?
You know, that indicates that they have probably had some type of cultural competency training where they are comfortable working with this community. And part of why we pointed this out in the report is I think there's a lot of providers in Missouri that probably don't even know that this provider online database even exists. And so hopefully part of the putting out this report is that just getting that fact out there, I hope that we have more providers in Missouri that are comfortable and have been trained in working with this population and just aren't aware that they can go and you know, register with this online provider network where members of this community, of the LGBT community, go to this online database to actually look for providers that would be comfortable for the patient and for the provider for them to access. And another thing that's pointed out in the report is that of those providers that have registered with this network, that they are all within 20 miles of the five main urban areas in the state. And so really, LGBT families in the more rural parts of Missouri are really challenged to find providers that are affirming, that are welcoming to this population.
Yeah, I read in the report that they're all within 20 miles of Kansas City, Springfield, Columbia, and St. Louis, kind of the bigger urban areas in Missouri. And I want to get into more of the differences of rural and urban care, but I also want to invite our listeners to join the conversation. This hour, we're talking about disparities in healthcare for LGBT communities, especially in Missouri. Our guests are Ryan Barker of the Missouri Foundation for Health and Stephen Lohman of the Kansas City Free Health Clinic. If you'd like to join our conversation, we'd like to have you. Our number is 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or you can send us an email at updatedate@kcur.org or on Twitter at @kcuruptodate. So back to you, Ryan Barker. Can you talk a little bit more about the gap that exists between rural and urban communities and some of the discrimination that some people living in rural communities face here in Missouri?
Absolutely. So part of what we found, the census has started collecting some very basic information on the LGBT, not really the transgender community, but the LGBT community. And what we found is that there are same-sex couples living in 95% of Missouri's counties. So we know that same-sex couples are out there, which would lead us to think that there are probably gay and lesbian individuals in every county in Missouri. And the more isolated rural counties, not only can you not find sort of the providers that are welcoming and affirming, but it's a very isolating where compared to a more urban area where you can have that, as I was talking about with family versus finding your own community. In the urban areas, it's easier for the LGBT population to find that broader community outside of their biological family versus in more rural areas of the state, it's more difficult to find that social support in your community because you're either isolated or it's a very small community, and there may not be other individuals or families that are comfortable or are out as lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender. So that really leads to some of these health disparities being greater in the rural areas. When you're feeling isolated, when you're feeling stressed, that really takes a toll on your mental health status.
Stephen, do you see people coming into the clinic from rural areas making the drive to Kansas City to receive this type of care?
Sometimes. I mean, but most of the time we only do within, like, the Jackson County area at the clinic. And then they have to have, like, proof of residency and income. And we do the underinsured and the uninsured. So, but, I mean, I know that there is the LGBT therapist guild that's in the Kansas City Metro that does do LGBT-affirming therapists and things like that.
And Stephen points out, I mean, it's a great point in that we hear throughout the state and from the general population that transportation related to healthcare is a huge concern. And that same concern applies to the LGBT population of, you know, there probably aren't a lot of patients coming from outside the KC Metro region to this free clinic because of transportation issues. And it can take, you take a whole day off work to try to get there? Do you try to find a ride? But we know just from traveling the state that many people in communities around the state identify transportation as a huge barrier to healthcare access.
Hmm. Stephen, you work with a couple different counties, though, as well, doing prevention care.
Correct. We do the 11-county Kansas City Transgressional Grant Area, and we do, I think it's 8 counties on the Missouri side, so we go, you know, out to, you know, the rural areas. But very rarely do we actually go out and do prevention at those locations because it's, you know, harder to get, you know, the, you know, health departments and different places because there is the stigma with, you know, the HIV prevention that it's not here, even though everyone knows that it, you know, is everywhere. So, I mean, that's one thing that we have ran into. But I know in the last year we have done a couple events outside of, you know, the Kansas City Metro, like Warrensburg and some other places. So I know that we are trying to get out there.
Were they pretty well received by the community?
I know we went to, like, the University of Central Missouri in Warrensburg, and it was very well received, the testing event that we held there.
I want to switch gears and talk a little bit more about transgender individuals. The report found that because insurance companies don't offer certain types of coverage, transgender individuals often seek healthcare services through unconventional means, such as through self-administered hormone treatments and silicone injections. Ryan, is this a case where some companies will cover some treatments, or is it pretty much all across the board that they say no to these procedures?
So it's mixed. I mean, I think there are some employers that are moving towards being more inclusive of care specifically targeted at the transgender community. But in general, Medicare, Medicaid, and private insurance either don't cover these type of procedures or prescriptions, or if they say they cover it, then they often deny it because it's experimental or not medically necessary. And so it is a huge concern for the transgender community that they don't have access to these type of treatments, and then they're self-administering some of these hormones, which can have really detrimental effects on their health.
This is Up to Date on KCUR. We're talking about health disparities in the LGBT community. You can join our conversation, 816-235-2888, 816-235-2888. Are you a member of the LGBT community? Do the results of this study reflect your experiences when accessing care? We'd like to hear from you. You can also contact us on our Facebook page, kcur.org, or an email, updatedate@kcur.org. So back to transgender issues. I know it may seem obvious, but Stephen, what are the dangers here when a transgender individual takes treatment into his or her own hands?
That's something that they shouldn't do, but I mean, that might be the only option. But I mean, it's not something that you should do because, you know, you need a medical provider to give you,
Have you witnessed that?
I haven't witnessed it, but I mean, they might. I mean, I'm not sure what they witnessed down in the actual clinic in the Gen Med area, so.
According to the paper, also 1 in 5 transgender individuals reported to have been denied care by a medical provider. Ryan, can you speak to that? Is there some discrimination or cultural competency that needs to happen that's geared more specifically towards transgender individuals in healthcare settings?
Absolutely. So I think there's a lot of misunderstanding, fear, discrimination. harassment, even among the general community, which then translates to our provider community. So it's there is, while we often talk about this population as LGBT, sexual orientation and gender identity are different. And so the issues are very different. And we see much greater levels of harassment, rejection, discrimination from providers within the transgender community. And so that really, we really see high numbers of transgender adults that delay or don't seek care due to cost, due to discrimination within the provider's office. And so that does relate to cultural competency training, getting information out there to providers about working with this population.
So there are a number of different factors that go into this report. One of them is health behaviors. There's some unhealthy behaviors we'd probably find in many sectors of the population, but are actually higher among LGBT segments, smoking and drinking, for example. Do you have any speculations on why that is, Stephen?
I'm not really sure why, but I do notice that in my clients and even in my group of friends, that those are two of the main things that I notice that every one of them does. And I don't know why.
Ryan, perhaps you can speak more on that.
Absolutely. So we see in minority groups, and not just with the LGBT community, but with race and ethnicity or different other minority groups, that they experience higher levels of discrimination, harassment, stressors in your daily life. So when you face either a workplace that may be hostile or just in the community, that has an impact on your mental health. And so all of us experience stress in our daily life. People deal with that stress in different ways, and it's called coping mechanisms. And some people within the LGBT community and within the general population deal with that stress in a healthy way, whether it's, you know, going out and getting physical exercise, having a therapist that you speak to. But many of us in the general population and in the LGBT population deal with that stress and that extra burden in ways that are not the healthiest behaviors. And so that's, we see much higher rates of smoking, of substance abuse, increased drinking, binge drinking, that type of activity. And they're really forms of coping with that stress that these communities feel on a daily basis.
And when you combine these habits with a population that's already behind in health services, it can really explode into a really serious health situation. Have you seen that?
So part of what the report looks at is one, yes, these health behaviors, and then ultimately, what do they lead to? And we call those health outcomes. And so when you combine things like these unhealthy behaviors with, higher rates of being uninsured, less likely to access primary care and prevention, then you see health outcomes where mortality rates, so cancer deaths, people are accessing care later, or going to the emergency room, and their cancer is further along. We see higher rates of asthma in this community. So these do have long-term sort of health outcome effects, these daily health behaviors.
We have a call here from Kelly in Olathe. Kelly, welcome to Up to Date.
Hi. I just had a question. I recently, I'm on the radio, so nobody knows who I am, but I recently had Juvederm done, and it's a filler, and it's cosmetic. And when I was doing research about it, I stumbled onto these other types of fillers, and I found this something called a pumping party.
Can you describe what a filler is, please, maybe to our audience?
Yeah, that sure. A filler is kind of like, Botox freezes the muscle to get rid of wrinkles. A filler is what plastic surgeons use to kind of put volume back in your face as you age, and it's completely cosmetic, and it's injectable. Well, they have this product called liquid silicone that when I was online, I found a lot of warnings about that these pumping parties where transgendered individuals were getting together, and because they couldn't afford the breast implants and the buttocks implants, were injecting liquid silicone into these areas to create volume and change their figure. And by doing so, they were, like, dying. And I was just wondering if your guests had any experience or had heard about these things and could explain a little bit more, because I can only see how expensive it would be to go through the surgeries to become the physical version of what you feel inside. And I'll take my response off air. Thank you.
Any response to that or any other sort of non-traditional medicine and treatment that's causing problems in the LGBT community?
I haven't experienced a pumping party, so I don't know.
Maybe Ryan?
You know, I don't have experience with that either, but I think the report talks about this exact issue that Kelly brought up was if you are self-administering hormones or these type of treatments, that it causes serious health consequences for transgender individuals. And that could be risk of blood clotting, high blood pressure, increased blood sugar levels, and it damages the liver. It can cause, you know, disturbances in our electrolytes and the way our blood pressure works. And when you combine those type of unregulated self-administering hormones with things like increased tobacco use, increased obesity, it really leads to health outcomes such as heart attacks and strokes. So it's a huge concern. And part of the issue is that a lot of these treatments are not covered by health insurance nationally or in Missouri.
Do you think that patients are reluctant to go to doctors for stuff like this, that they feel maybe embarrassed or just don't have the confidence in their provider to go to the doctor for this?
Yeah, I think it's a combination of things. So I think it's a combination of the health insurance not covering it, providers being uncomfortable or unaware of these type of treatments. And so trying to find a provider that works with transgender individuals is really difficult. And so a lot of people and the cost of these type of hormones are really expensive and prohibitive. And so I think those factors all lead to transgender individuals sort of taking this upon themselves and trying to self-administer these types of prescriptions.
And there's also some social inequality and discrimination. The report says LGBT individuals face higher rates of unemployment and underemployment. Transgender individuals experience twice the rates of unemployment and poverty than the general population. Ryan, why do you think that it is exactly?
So one of the things that the report looks at is what are the current policies in Missouri that sort of impact the health of the LGBT population. And one of the things the report points out is that in Missouri, we do not have any employment discrimination laws that impact sexual orientation or gender identity. We don't have any housing discrimination laws for this population. And so both in the employment, unless that employer has their own sort of non-discrimination clause that includes sexual orientation and gender identity, there is nothing in state law that says you can't fire a person, you can't not promote a person because of their gender identity or because of their sexual orientation. And so part of what's in this report is pointing out the statistics of how many people in the LGBT community experience employment discrimination, housing discrimination as just part of their life.
You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. We're talking about health disparities in the LGBT community. You can join our conversation at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. I'm Suzanne Hogan, in for Steve Kraske, and this is Up to Date. And welcome back to Up to Date. I'm Suzanne Hogan, in for Steve Kraske. If you missed yesterday's visit with the Texperts, you'll find it and all of our previous broadcasts at kcur.org. Tomorrow on the program, Steve Kraske joins us with an update from the Democratic National Convention. Also a look at energy production in Missouri and Kansas. And Brian McTavish returns with our weekend to-do list. This hour, we're discussing disparities in healthcare for the LGBT community. Our guests are Ryan Barker of the Missouri Foundation for Health and Stephen Lohman from the Kansas City Free Health Clinic. If you'd like to join our conversation, we'd like to have you. Our number is 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Our email address is uptodate at kcur.org, and you can reach us via Twitter at kcuruptodate or join us on KCUR's Facebook. So if you're part of the LGBT community in Missouri, it is very likely that you're already behind in finding and receiving health services. But if you add certain socioeconomic factors, you're at risk for the gap growing even more. Ryan, can you talk about some of those factors, poverty, no protection really against unemployment, housing discrimination?
Right. So all of those factors really add up. And so, you know, we don't exist as individuals in a box where we're just one thing. And so part of what the report points out is that if you are belong to multiple minority groups, that the impacts on your health sort of multiply. And so things like being a woman, being of a racial or ethnic minority group, being an older American, being in a rural area, all of those are sort of things that we look at the foundation as part of health disparities and health equity. And when an individual has multiple identities, and so maybe they're African American, maybe they're a woman, maybe they're a lesbian, those different identifications, demographics overlap. And so they cause the disparities to get even greater. And that's part of what this report points out is we don't exist in isolation and we belong to multiple identity groups.
One thing that I found interesting, it said that LGBT families are more likely to be multiracial than heterosexual families.
Absolutely. I think that really talks to that it is more difficult for same-sex couples to have children. And often it's either involved some, medical procedures or adoption. And so we know that if we look at the foster care system, that there is a majority of foster children who are of a minority race or ethnicity. And so bringing those children into same-sex couples and adoption leads to multiracial families, which sort of gives then a whole nother aspect to health and healthcare, because you're once again sort of bringing in race and ethnicity into a family structure and having people of multiple identities within that family structure.
And you see that they seem to experience more discrimination with their sexual or gender identity, but then also ethnic discrimination. Can you talk about some of the systematic policies that encourage that discrimination?
Absolutely. So I already mentioned like housing and employment and that there are no protections for those in Missouri. Now, we do have about 10 municipalities in Missouri, although mostly in the urban areas, that do have some discrimination protections for this population. Missouri does have a hate crime law that does include sexual orientation and gender identity. One of the other things that is probably a little bit more controversial is sort of relationship recognition laws. Missouri both has a statute and a constitutional amendment that defines marriage as between a man and a woman. And while that's very political, it also has some real impact on people's lives. So same-sex couples have difficulty accessing like insurance for a spouse. So unless that employer happens to offer domestic partner benefits, oftentimes in a same-sex couple, the spouse is just left out of health insurance. So you may see one member of that family structure having health insurance and the other not being able to afford it, because they work in a job that doesn't offer health insurance, or they work part-time, or they work in a certain industry that doesn't often offer health insurance. So those type of relationship recognition laws have an impact on people's health and their access to health care.
Stephen, have you experienced this at the clinic?
I was actually going to speak from personal experience.
Oh, please do.
My partner and I did not have – I had health insurance and he did not. And we actually were married in the state of Iowa. But, because it's not recognized here, we weren't able to, put him on my insurance. So I actually have personal experience with that.
Can you also speak more, both of you feel free to jump into medical decision making and how that in LGBT relationships, how that can translate to maybe not the best care in situations where, say, maybe a partner's in the hospital and not able to have the same rights, say, because they can't legally – they're not legally married. Have you noticed that has affected care for this population? Or like that it affects the culture?
Right. So one of the things is President Obama did put out a regulation around Medicare and hospitals that hospitals have to give visitation rights to same-sex couples. However, in Missouri, we don't have – so medical decision-making – If a same-sex couple has a power of attorney that identifies their spouse or partner as someone who can make medical decisions, then that will be observed within a hospital setting. But if you haven't taken the step of actually going to an attorney and creating this medical power of attorney, then if your partner goes into a hospital, you can be denied as the partner the ability to make medical decisions for that person. There is no protections in Missouri, regardless of how long you may have been together. And part of that really stems from what I was just talking about in terms of relationship recognition. So if there's no recognition that relationship exists, then it does have issues when you enter the healthcare system in terms of making medical decisions. Until recently, it impacted people's visitation rights within a hospital setting.
LGBT individuals are less likely than heterosexual persons to have a regular source of basic health care. They're also more likely to receive health care services in emergency rooms. And Stephen, I was wondering, does it seem like members of the LGBT community that come to your clinic avoid taking preventative care measures and they let chronic health problems get out of hand because they don't feel comfortable enough to seek out care when it's needed right away?
I think some do, but I don't think, a lot do. But I mean, that's not a question that I really know the answer to, because it's not something that we ask. So,
Ryan Barker?
Yeah, so I think that it's the there's sort of multiple factors that lead to that not accessing preventative care. So some of it is that we do have the LGBT population is 1.5 times more likely to be uninsured. So right there, if you're uninsured, you're less likely to access preventative care because you don't have the insurance to pay for it. And then you bring in the factor about cultural competency and providers being trained to work with this population. And so the LGBT community is may not be comfortable going to the doctor. And so then they avoid that situation and they don't get preventative care. And then we often see that cost is a factor. So if you don't have insurance and you go to the doctor, you're paying out of pocket. So it's more expensive. And so we see people delaying care because they don't want to have to swallow those costs without health insurance, which means that a lot of times things like diabetes, asthma go untreated, and people don't access health care until they enter the emergency room and they have to.
Yeah, the LGBT community is less likely to get preventative care like cancer screenings. The study said pap smears. How badly does this compound things over time? I mean, we talked about HIV and AIDS, but these are just basic screenings, health screenings that people need to do every so often. And if they're not doing that, things can really get out of hand quickly. Have you seen that happen?
So absolutely. So part of what's in the report is that because the community avoids these type of preventative screenings and doesn't access them, then we see that when they are diagnosed with either cancer or diabetes or some sort of chronic condition, it's much further down the line. Which means that there's higher rates of mortality or death due to things like cancer, because if you're not getting these screenings, you end up in the emergency room when your cancer is in stage 3 or stage 4. Mm-hmm. And we know that, when cancer has advanced that far, the there are higher chances of death relating to that cancer.
Two statistics that were in the study that I found were interesting. Lesbians have the highest risk factors for breast cancer of all women worldwide. Also, gay men have higher rates of anal cancers and anal papilloma than heterosexual men. Gay men should begin HPV and cancer screening starting by age 20. What type of outreach is being done to let people know about their risks in these areas, Stephen? Does the clinic have pamphlets or literature to try to really let people of this population know that they're at a higher risk?
We've started talking about the HPV and the HPV vaccine and, educating people, because that's a question that we get a lot in the community, especially now that they have said, that boys and men are allowed to get it, up until 26 now. So that's something, that has been brought to our attention here recently. So we have started, incorporating that into our outreaches.
Ryan Barker, have you seen there'd be efforts to have more outreach about these specific issues within Missouri and even across the nation?
Well, I think this goes back to our earlier discussion about why it is important that patients feel comfortable self-identifying. to providers that they are lesbian or gay or bisexual or transgender, because the provider can't read people's minds and can't know that they are, you know, that they face higher risk factors for things like anal cancer or breast cancer unless they know that their patient, unless they know their sexual orientation or their gender identity. And so that's part of the reason why it's so important to create these welcoming and open providers that people feel comfortable going in and self-identifying. And then the provider's aware, okay, now if I've had training, I know that this population needs to make sure that they've had these type of cancer screenings. And so it goes back and forth. And this is sort of cyclical where it's a chicken or the egg. Like the providers need training and need to be aware and need to create a welcoming environment. But the patients also need to be comfortable enough to self-identify to that provider.
You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. We're talking about health disparities within the LGBT community. You can give us a call at 816-235-2888 to join the conversation or send us an email at updatedate@kcur.org. We're going to talk to Renee now. Renee, welcome to Up to Date.
Thank you for taking my call. I had a quick question, and I'll take the answer off the air. You were discussing multiple subgroups and within the LGBT community, and one of the rarely discussed but very real subgroups within that community is the leather or BDSM community. And I wanted to know if your report had any recommendations for people finding understanding providers that were aware of that community, or if either of you had any recommendations for that. I'd also like, before you end the program, if you could give us the website or the link to the online provider network for providers. And thank you very much. Okay.
Thank you, Renee. Ryan, do you have a response to that?
Sure. So in terms of the leather or BDSM community, there are subgroups within any community. So if you look at racial or ethnic community, there are subgroups within that. And oftentimes LGBT gets grouped together because there's a history of discrimination and sort of a commonality. But there are really different subgroups within this community. And part of our data issues is that it is really difficult to have the data for these subgroups within the community, which is oftentimes why you see this group together as LGBT. And that's part of why we are excited that the Affordable Care Act actually pushes the federal government to start collecting data on sexual orientation within national health surveys. And so we think that's going to give us a lot more data and information in order to address these. So unfortunately, Renee, there isn't a lot of information or data around that subgroup community. And I am unaware of specific providers that would be comfortable. But I think that points directly to why cultural competency training is important, because part of it should include what are some of the subgroups included in the LGBT community. And then her second question around the provider network, I don't have it in front of me. If you would Google Gay and Lesbian Medical Association, you go to their website, and then you would see the provider lookup online tool on the GLMA website.
And Ryan, I'll point out to Renee that that will be linked to our website as well at kcur.org, in addition to the report that Ryan Barker helped edit. I want to talk now about LGBT youth. That's a section in the report that was pretty interesting. It said that today the average age of individuals coming out or verbalizing their sexual orientation and gender identity is 13, and that's nearly a decade younger than the average age of people coming out a decade ago. What do you think is changing that children are feeling more open to come out in our society?
I really think that it has to do a lot with social media and the internet and people feeling connected. And so we talked earlier about how individuals in rural communities often felt very isolated. And 20 years ago, they were very isolated, and it was hard to connect with people that were like you, that were part of your community, outside of that rural area. And nowadays, with internet and with that type of communication, people can connect. We also see changing attitudes towards the LGBT community in this country, which makes people more comfortable, allows them to self-identify at an earlier age. But having that average age be to 13 creates its own set of issues. In some ways, it's good that youth can self-identify earlier and have time to be comfortable with that. But it also creates problems. And as the report points out, only about 50% of LGBT youth feel like they have a family member that they can turn to for help. So only half these kids have someone they can turn to, compared to their straight counterparts that it's about 80% feel like they have a family member that they can turn to for concerns and questions. And really that translates into what we see is that homeless youth are about twice as likely to be LGBT compared to the general population. So because these youth are coming out earlier, they may face rejection within their own family, which often leads to homelessness. And so it's a huge concern, I think, nationally, that this exact issue of coming out earlier, there's pros and cons.
And you've been working with at-risk youth for a long time in Ohio and Oregon, is that correct?
I did. So in a previous life, I was a social worker that worked at that homeless drop-in shelters in both Portland, Oregon and Cincinnati, Ohio. And I definitely saw this, especially in Portland. I would actually put it, the statistic nationally is about 20% of homeless youth identify as LGBT. In the organization I worked with in Portland, I would put that percentage probably closer to 40% of the clients that we worked with identified as part of this community. And most of them became homeless because of rejection from their biological families.
Stephen, do you have a lot of LGBT youth coming into the clinic? And
We actually do not do youth at the Kansas City Free Health Clinic. Our cutoff is 18. So we do testing for anyone 13 and above, but to actually be seen in the general medicine clinic, you have to be an adult.
So that's interesting. Do you know of other providers that are reaching this population of kids that fall into that age group?
I want to say like SWOP Healthcare Services, I think, is one of them that we pretty much always turn people to.
Well, so Ryan, is there a lack of coverage in this area for this age group? I mean, where do kids have a place to turn to?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm not as familiar with Kansas City. It's not part of our sort of service region. But in the St. Louis area, there is what is called the SPOT. It's part of Washington University, and it's sort of a drop-in center medical clinic for kids, for youth up to 18, up to 21, I think, actually. As Stephen and I just pointed out, most of these very specific services are offered in our more urban areas. And so there are limited resources in our urban areas for youth to access. But once again, sort of those rural or smaller towns and cities in Missouri and around the country, there's a lack of services for youth to access, which really creates problems because youth are even less likely to be able to use transportation to go to one of the more urban areas and access care that is specifically targeted for this community.
816-235-2888 if you'd like to join our conversation about the health disparities in the LGBT community in Missouri. During 4 years of education, the average medical student spends about 5 hours learning about LGBT health issues. Why do you think that is, and why hasn't that changed?
Yeah, so that it was one of the surprising things. I think our medical schools, the curriculum is crammed. I mean, it's just very full 4 years, and there's not a lot of room to add new curriculum. And I think medical schools, and I'm not an expert on this, but they focus a lot on disease-specific training, and so there isn't as much curriculum around population base. And so the LGBT community, thinking of it more as a population, doesn't get as much attention in medical school. And so the place where the community does come up is around HIV and AIDS, which we do see higher rates of HIV among gay men. But there, as this report points out, there's a whole lot other health issues that impact this community other than HIV. And there has been some movement. I know that at Washington University Medical School here in St. Louis, I have been asked to come speak to first and second year medical students on this issue of LGBT health disparities. So I know they're trying to sort of fit it in where they can. And right now, I think a lot of the opportunities in medical school are outside of the formal curriculum. And they're often student driven. So the medical students actually are who reached out to me to say, hey, come do a luncheon presentation, we'll order pizza, and you come talk to us about this population. And I was happy to do that. But it's outside of the formal curriculum in medical school.
We're getting towards the end of the show, but I wanted to talk also about LGBT elders. Nearly one half of LGBT elders are living with a disability. Why is that, Ryan?
You know, I think that translates similar to the general population. It's a little bit higher rates, and part of that is this a history of not accessing preventative care, not having the same rates of health insurance. And so those chronic diseases aren't managed over time. And so then when we reach older age, those chronic diseases often catch up with us, especially if they haven't been treated or sort of managed along the way. And so part of that, this all leads back to that not accessing preventative care, not feeling comfortable in a provider's office, not having a regular source of care. It catches up with us as we age. And unfortunately, that's what leads to some of these disparities among older LGBT adults.
Stephen, do you see a lot of these older Missourians in your clinic?
Yes, we are starting to see people, you know, that are actually coming to, you know, get the preventative care that they do need.
So let's talk quickly about policy. We're getting towards the end of the show. What action can be done? We have this report now. We've learned a lot about the disparities. But what is being done to change policy that continues to create these gaps and disparities in Missouri?
So part of the report, and this is what I think is really exciting about this report, and as you mentioned, I was just an editor. One of our policy fellows actually wrote this report, and Cheryl Winter did an excellent job. And part of what the report really points out is what are the current policies in place in Missouri that impact the health of the LGBT population. But then she also went into what are recommended policies. And there, the report, and there's too many to really go through, but it looks at access to care and what are some policies that we could do in Missouri to actually improve access to care for this population. And then it goes through prevention, clinical care, health behaviors, and then health outcomes, and looks at what are policies that Missouri could do at the state level to really reduce the disparities for this population and improve their access to care.
Ryan Barker and Stephen Lohman, I want to thank you for joining us on Up to Date this morning.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for having me.
Ryan Barker is the Health Policy Director for the Missouri Foundation for Health. Stephen Lohman is Prevention Specialist for the Kansas City Free Health Clinic. You'll find more information about our guests, details about our program, and previous broadcasts at kcur.org. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Tomorrow on the program, Steve Kraske joins us from the Democratic National Convention. Also, a look at energy production in Missouri and Kansas, and Brian McTavish returns with our weekend to-do list. Our show is produced by Steven Steigman with help from Danny Alexander. I'm Suzanne Hogan, and you are up to date.